This is KAZU FM, and it's Pacific Grove, California. And this is Mae Brussel, and it's broadcast number 659, July 23rd, 1984. This time last year, we usually begin the program with a quick resume of how fast the year went. I was talking about Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger, reminding of you just 2 years ago. Actually, it was in July of 82, and we brought up in 1983 the reunion at the Bohemian Grove where they were actually playing Hail to the Chief for Henry Kissinger, hoping, of course, that as he worked his way into the Reagan administration, and he's had two juicy appointments since then, hoping someday he could become President of the United States. And I also was giving a lot of information about Vicki Morgan, who had just been murdered, and her interest in showbiz pizza, her relationship to King Faisal of Morocco, and Vernon Walters of the Vatican, and the Vatican connections of Alfred Bloomingdale, Vicki Morgan, and Vernon Walters, and members of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, the closeness of the Vatican agents with Reinhard Gehlen, William Casey, William Clark, James Eggleston, and Walters, and their tie into the Reagan administration, and both Vicki and Bloomingdale. And, of course, Marvin Mitchelson, the attorney for Vicki Morgan, said that those tapes did, in fact, exist. That was a year ago, and Alfred Bloomingdale died of cancer last August in 1983. It was just before he died that she spoke up and wanted money, a settlement, because her money had been cut off. And the day that her huge bank account was cut off was the exact day that Licio Gelli was hanging and dangling over the bridge in London, had been murdered, and he affected many, many banks and the Vatican connection. I did a chart last year, broadcast number 607, that July 25th, of the interrelationship of Alfred Bloomingdale, Vicki Morgan, and people involved with the John Kennedy assassination and the Manson family. Apropos of that, Mr. Pancoast had said he was involved with the one of the Manson family murders, or some of them, or part of the whole group. Some of the programs I charted out, and I have to do more of that, so you get a better picture. It's hard to describe in a few sentences the interrelationship of people. It's hard for you to remember that. So I'll be doing more charting, of course, as time goes on. I do want to tell you, this past week, my father passed away. I had the program here Monday and then went to Los Angeles early Tuesday morning at 6 in the morning. I had a feeling I should get up early. I usually leave at 8. He passed away around 11:30, about 2 hours before I got there. Some of you know it. I want to thank you for your letters and telephone calls. I've been home since last night, and the phone was ringing Sunday night. And today, when we went out to the cemetery where he was buried, my grandmother is in the same cemetery. His mother was born in 1870 in San Francisco, and he was born in 1890 in San Francisco. And had an interesting life there. It was a cosmopolitan city, and he was unlike other rabbis around the country because he grew up with the various people that congregated and got along well in that particular area, the fishing boats coming in, the ships coming in from Asia and around the world, and there was a lot of music and art. It was a colorful city, and then he went to college in Cincinnati and then lived in Los Angeles for 65 years in one congregation. We had a lot of differences, of course. A lot of the people that I put on the air and describe, such as Richard Nixon, when I wrote my first story on Watergate, it horrified him because he was asked by Richard Nixon to give a part of the religious service when Nixon was inaugurated. I talk about Ed Davis or Evel Younger, former DA in L.A., and then the Attorney General of California. They were at his funeral this Friday. Those were his friends. I have talked about Peter Pitches and the Manson family, and but he knew those people at a different level. They liked him on first-name basis. In fact, they loved him, and he was very popular in Los Angeles. Not everybody liked him, but they all respected him, and he had a lot of fond associations with that city growing, and he did a good job with every civic organization. How did we get along, May, the researcher, and Rabbi Magnin, a civic-minded person associating with all the people that by just coincidence happened to be subjects that I would be investigating. I didn't look for them, but they sort of fit into place, people that he knew, like John McCloy or John McCone from World Affairs Council, these different people. In all fairness to Edgar, my dad, he was the kind of person who said, I don't want to know the kind of things you're doing because that doesn't interest me. He didn't grasp the ideas. He didn't care about them. He didn't care if Lee Harvey Oswald's closest associate was a Nazi during the war. He didn't even care about Nazis. But he said, I give you the right to do whatever you want. And I might have mentioned this before on a program. You can't argue with that. About 10 years ago, he had some insurance policies, and he said to my brother and myself, you know, I'm not going to wait till I die. I think I'll cash these in now, and you can have an income every month, a check, and you don't have to worry about things, and if there's anything more you need, I'll give it to you. So this was coming in every month, and he didn't care if I bought books and filing cabinets and didn't go to the places where maybe when I grew up he thought I would want to go. He gave me the freedom to do everything I've done. And so you, the people that listen to this or get the cassettes or get the articles I write or any of the information I have access to are the beneficiaries of all that. That is a pretty broad-minded person. And my mother is the same way too. Don't ask me to read what you write because I don't like that kind of stuff. But if other people like it, you do it. And I know you're doing it well. And that was the relationship we had. The way we got along is the way all families should get along. They don't, but we had a good formula. We found the things we had in common, whether it was reading Shakespeare or listening to the symphony, and I would bring down operas for them, and we'd listen to the evening concert and music and children and grandchildren that they loved, and now great-grandchildren. My brother has sons have some children. So we found the things that we had in common to do with each other. And what we didn't have in common, we did separately. When they'd go to bed, when they do rest, when I go down there, I wait till they're in bed at 10, and then I do my reading and research in newspapers maybe till 2 in the morning. From the time I arrived down in L.A., and I've been going down every 2 or 3 or 4 weeks for the last 3 or 4 years, because Mother is now 90 and Dad was 94. So from the time he was 90 and she was 86, I've spent a lot of time there, and I drive back and forth and do the work, keep up the work, and give them that time. So it was well worth it. As I say, he understood what I was doing, and I don't think there are very many families that have that kind of an opportunity where people have the means to give you something to do what you like to do and have not expect nothing from you in return for it, other than being a daughter that he could enjoy and be proud of for what I was doing, as I say, even if he didn't want to know what it was. So we had an unusual relationship. My mother is 90, and she's doing just fine. I had to make her stay home Saturday instead of going over to the club where she has lunch on Saturday. She explained to my aunt, well, I think May should go out. She's been in the house all week. We had 2 funerals, one Thursday for the family and relatives, and then one down at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, which was very beautiful, and he built that temple. I remember the groundbreaking. I was 4 years old, and the stained glass, the murals, and it is a beautiful synagogue, and it's a monument to him and the things he planned and wanted. But as I say, I'm indebted to him and my mother for being able to do what I do, and therefore, we were very close. I appreciated that, and I'm very happy that we had this time together. Now on to some other subjects real quick. One thing I want to specify, for a half hour on Henry Kissinger, but there are a few short subjects I want to update you. One, I'll do more on the James Oliver Huberty shootout at McDonald's. Not a lot, but along those lines. But there was an article in the Chronicle today, Mass Killer's Brain to be Put in Cold Storage. Now, this is the same thinking of Dr. Vernon Mark, former chief of neurosurgery at Boston Hospital, and Dr. Frank Urban, professor of psychiatry at UCLA. They took the brains of black people who rioted in Detroit to see why some blacks are restless when others are not. And what they wanted to do, like the beginning of the mind experiment related to violence started with the Whitman boy, and his brains were missing. And John Conley in Texas began with Dr. Sweet, and Dr. Urban and Dr. Mark, rather, and also a Dr. Sweet, and were supposed to send his brains to Boston, and they were never seen. just as Donald DeFries of the SLA had his head cut off and the body with the neck was sent to Ohio and the head wasn't seen. What they want to do in this society of 1984 of mind control is to try to blame physical pressures for violence instead of the sociological relationship of these people who are doing the violence to where they worked as security guards, how they were trained to shoot, what countries they were in where they could be mind controlled. And they traveled them around and put them right in the middle of a Chicano, a Latin community where he puts on his fatigue suit and goes out as a real soldier. The idea to put his brain in cold storage is ridiculous, and they will spend millions of dollars, where the answer is who manipulates this James from the time he was a little boy, who had their hands on him and his behavior so that he could trigger this off. Again, this is the way World War III could start, by just somebody putting on his uniform and saying, I'm going to hunt people. This is the same lingo that the Klan and Nazis had down on the island of Dominica. I've used it before, that involved John Conley and some wealthy people in Texas. And the Nazi party had a flag made for that island. They didn't take over that invasion. It failed. But they, at the time, I heard, were going to bring blacks from Africa and turn them loose on this island and hunt them. So this lingo, I'm going to go hunt people, wearing the American fatigue. Also, he blamed the Trilateral Commission and Jimmy Carter. He was one of the dangerous posse comitatus, the special private army, the Soldiers of Fortune. He was one of that group whose lingo was that the Trilateral Commission was a threat to the United States, so he kills down 22 poor people who aren't members of the Trilateral Commission. Somebody should have sent him up to Bohemian Grove, and maybe he could have done his job there. Just one quick update on the story I did last week on William Wilson and the Vatican and how he stays on the boards of two corporations. The New York Times updated it. The case of the Vatican envoy is unexplained. The State Department made public their policy on corporate directors and how ambassadors cannot be directors on corporations, but they refuse under the Privacy Act considerations to explain why Mr. Wilson is allowed to be with Pennzoil, which is a conflict of interest because Will Wilson's friendship with Mark Rich and Henry Kissinger and the various oil hoaxes and countries surrounding the oil scam, such as in Italy, the oil and Lizzo jelly, the various relationships he has to oil companies could be very much related to his oil company. It has to be if you're out there competing on these markets. So the story of Wilson will not be told, at least not yet, and they won't allow it open hearings to say what's going on. He happens to own 327,000 shares of Pennzoil, which is $10 million in one oil company alone, and then he's on the board with Jorgensen, Earl Jorgensen, that's the kitchen cabinet of Ronald Reagan and Steele. And I imagine he works like the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. I imagine that his contact from the Vatican goes to the corporation. So in order to spy and carry messages, he has to have the board meetings as an excuse to come to the United States. Then he couldn't be a good spy if he just went to the Vatican and back. Maybe you saw the Edwin Meese extension in your newspapers. It didn't make a lot of the wire service. Edwin Meese given second extension for disclosure. His statement of financial disclosures was supposed to be ready by May the 15th. He's been given another deadline, August 13th. This is our future attorney general who is wiggling his money around and can't get the papers together yet on how there was a $15,000 interest-free loan that he didn't disclose. Remember, the Edwin Meese story is sitting on ice, waiting until the elections are over, and Reagan hopes he can appoint him. And if he doesn't appoint him, if there is a landslide and Mondale wins, then they won't go into Meese anyway, and the whole relationship stays intact. Now, hopefully next week I will go at length into an update of the Vatican story, which has been brewing for a long time. But there were several interesting items this week. I just want to mention them. One from the San Francisco Chronicle. Pope plot prosecutor may not have a case. And this is a story about linking Mehmet Aja, the man who shot the Pope and didn't kill the Pope, to the KGB Bulgarian connections. The allegations are falling apart. There's no positive proof that he could communicate intelligently with Antonov. They said that he was supposed to be isolated at the time of his conviction, and he's been speaking with people from the CIA and other people who could give him information that would put the plot together. Now, if this isn't a case and they can't prosecute it, do you think that Michael Ledeen or Claire Sterling or NBC Marvin Kalb would be demoted or taken off top news stories and become experts on terrorism after pulling this thing for 3 years? No, they'll go on being top experts anytime they want, but they can ruin a story or make a story, but if it doesn't wash, they just go back in and try another one. The LA Times had a story Saturday, July 14th. Aja retracted part of the testimony on the Bulgarians. He's changing his story, and I'll go into the details of what he's changing, but I want you to know that in addition to Meese extending his money problems and Mr. Wilson's papers tied up with the Privacy Act, so you don't know how he gets special breaks that other people don't get who are ambassadors, this story is falling apart. The New Times, coming from the Soviet Union, has an article, Wilson, Turple, and the Gray Wolves. This is about the CIA and the links to Aja and how we tried to form a plot of terrorists from other places where actually Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson of the CIA worked with Aja. I'll do more on that. And then a large article out of the Daily World, The Bulgarian Connection by Tom Foley, that a listener got for me on all the fascist Nazi right-wing connections of Aja. There wasn't a communist in the whole caboodle. And they compare it to Georgi Dimitrov, the Bulgarian communist leader who was framed in 1933 by the Nazis of burning down the Reichstag. I've mentioned that we've had a lot of Reichstags, the Korean airline, the 007. The incidences that create the chance that we could go to war, and if they could blame the KGB for killing the Pope if he had done it, the great Antichrist would fight Christ, and the Polish uprising, because it's a Polish Pope, would instigate and put us on the brink of World War III. Now, somebody called in the first part of this program about Joseph Mengele's NBC this morning, brought up Joseph Mengele's The Search for Mengele. You'd think it was a new name. Elizabeth Holzman was on, and a man named Menachem Rosensaft, R-O-S-E-N-S-A-F-T, and his mother. He has an organization called Children of the Holocaust. And they mentioned on the program that in 1960, Mengele's went to Paraguay, and the FBI and the Justice Department had on papers that it was a different Mengele's, and it was, in fact, Joseph Mengele's. Well, you know, I've written to Simon Wiesenthal and Mr. Mendelsohn in Washington, who's supposed to represent Jewish organizations, that this Mr. Joseph Mengele's has been in the United States, that, in fact, a newspaper today said, gave again the places where he's been. He goes to Miami, and I know he goes to Indiana, he goes to New Jersey, he has family in New Jersey, and he travels, he's been in California and Arizona, and the Justice Department will not give the officials down in Miami the aliases he used. They said that they couldn't do that during the privacy rules, that they couldn't give out the names of the aliases he used. I have written to Washington before and sent them copies of the FBI document. I've had it on the air many times about a man in Las Vegas who was with Joseph Mengele, who used the name Harold Endinan, E-N-D-I-N-A-N, in Riviera, Arizona. Now, Simon Wiesenthal and the officials at the Wiesenthal Center and in Washington tell me this isn't the same Mengele, but they won't tell you where the other one is. If this refers to a Mengele, they don't tell you how the mix-up came up. And furthermore, the information that began the search for this FBI document about Joseph Mengele came from a man who was sitting with him and his uncle in the Honduras. So they're telling me, just like they told the officials going back a few years ago in 1960, that it was a different person. That's what they tell me, but I know it's not true because this person, as I say, was with him. And, of course, the FBI document said that this Mengele's was naturalized December the 5th, 1932, and that they tried to take away his American citizenship February the 9th, 1944, because his name appeared on the Nazi Party list. I'll write to those people when I get a chance in New York and in Washington and see why they keep saying that this couldn't be the same person. Brian Richard Bolin, the fellow who surfaced in September 1978, looking for Mengele's, he's the one who's written a novel. It's too bad he did all that work and put it in the form of a novel, because he said he'd be killed if he didn't put it in novel form. It came out this year with no publicity after all that work. He did a lot of work on Mengele's. He's seen him in South America, and he's the one that told me of the relationship of Klaus Barbie with John DeLorean, and that the narcotics that DeLorean was to sell came from the Nazis down in Bolivia, and that he was familiar with them. Brian Bolin knows, and his co-worker knows, that Mengele's comes to the United States, knows about the tractor factory and the relatives that have the tractors in Midwest, and Indiana, New Jersey, and how he travels and gets around the world. The Wiesenthal Center had an update on Mengele's a few years ago and said that they were looking for him in Argentina, and that he one time was in the home of a Nazi sympathizer in Venezuela, and he skis in Switzerland. He may be up with John Paul II off of those Alps where he was skiing this week. He's also seen in the south of France, and he travels under various identities. He likes the name Gregory. He has a luxurious lifestyle. He was financed by his family, who live in the Bavarian town of Gunsberg. They set up a subsidiary in New Jersey to sell farm equipment to the United States. Well, why isn't Mengele's caught? Because he's part of the American government. He worked with, and I'll mention in a few minutes, SS Karl Wolf and Reinhard Gehlen. And the Pope John Paul II came right out of Auschwitz, where he worked for IG Farben. So Mengele's worked at Auschwitz, too. And they can't catch him. You know, the Klaus Barbie trial has been going on a year and a half. They had clear-cut evidence when they arrested him. You haven't heard a word about what's going on over in Europe, if that trial will begin. But Reinhard Gehlen came to the United States, and we still don't know who that Fritz Kramer is in the Pentagon, running every major decision of our country and pulling the strings for Henry Kissinger and his cohorts. So Mengele's has had a lot of mobility because he's worked with the people that want him to have it. And he's all of a sudden called a war criminal. He wasn't even wanted after the war. He was sitting in a coffee shop with his rich relatives when someone recognized him and he went out of town. But he wasn't wanted for anything. Now, Simon Wiesenthal, he has a center where he raises money to remember the Holocaust and what happened to the Jews in Germany. And in one of his brochures just about 2 years ago, this is what he wrote. He said, the picture emerged of a criminal, and he's talking about Joseph Mengele, permanently on the run. For a short time, we thought we had located Mengele in the Colonia Dignidad, an isolated German settlement in Chile. But then it seemed we had been misled by people who wanted to give the Colonia Dignidad a bad name. Not only the Chilean government and the colonia itself, but the Jewish community of Santiago de Chile strongly rejected those charges. Now, in the story of the SS by Enfield, it tells about Wiesenthal and Colonia Dignidad. If you read the books about Allende's murder and Orlando Letelier's murder, Death in Washington, the Embassy Row, and Death in Washington, the various books of the slaughter of a massive amount of citizens and particular individuals, Wiesenthal knows about the colonia. Why does he put in his brochure that he apologizes for saying Mengele's was there and that some naughty people want to give Colonia a bad name, when this is where they let loose the animals to eat people alive and teach torture and change their fingerprints and their facial their features, their bodies are altered so you don't recognize them. And it's an active place. Even today you can't get near it. It isn't a place like Auschwitz that is open for viewing. It was used by the police in Chile, Pinochet, the DINA, and I'm not aware that Pinochet's out of power or there's no colonia. And this is a question that I bring up over and over again, and I don't know the answer. I'm asking you, why are Jews like Elie Wiesel or Wiesenthal or Mendelssohn in Washington, why are they defending that thing which is indefensible, or saying that Mengele's isn't in this country when he is, or saying he wasn't naturalized when he was, or that the mistaken identity is now correct, that they made a mistake in 1960. They're waiting till these people die off and get acclamations for hunting something and some things which they're really not doing, and draw in millions and millions of dollars. don't rock any boats. They don't make anybody uncomfortable. And people like Mr. Boland can't get Mengele's because these people don't want him to get them. As I say, they've seen him and they know where he is. The People's World had an article on a hidden crisis regarding the Korean airline and other problems of Ronald Reagan. I'm wondering how many Democrats are going to use this or talk about it as a political issue. And this article, July 14th, says a great fear lurks in the hallways of the White House. It concerns lingering worldwide doubt about Reagan administration's version of what happened to the Korean airline flight 007 last September. There is more, even more explosive possibility that on the highest authority in Washington, the passengers on the plane were used. Inevitably, they would risk their life for an operation where they would risk their life, which is sacrificing Larry McDonald and then using the propaganda against the Russian and testing the Russian defense at the same time and getting rid of the Western Gulls witness for the trials that are coming up. This article says, so fearful is the administration that the continuing exposés and charges might add up to something significant, while the president, dressed in his new Dove disguise, that campaigning people should begin bringing this up and start to complain. And then it refers to the New York Times article of the reports of an unnamed administration official who was going to the Soviet Union to investigate this, and they repeated what I told you before, that Seymour Hersh of the New York Times was going to the Soviet Union to work on the 007. Now, I was very surprised at Seymour Hersh, but I mentioned before that he does some wonderful work, and then he'll pull back, and when he did the story of the murder of Allende and the coup in Chile, he actually wrote that the CIA wasn't involved. I think he retracted it later, but Seymour Hersh came out with that outlandish thing. So he's carrying the line now that, you know, that he's working on the Korean airline, but he isn't even considering Larry McDonald as an entity on there, as a member of Western Gulls, as a man who works with the Los Angeles Police Department, as a possibility that he could be wiped out. I talked to him, and he says that's impossible. Seymour told me that he doesn't believe any witness to any particular case has been killed in order not to testify. Now, that's how far gone he is, because the history books are filled with primary witnesses such as Georgia Morenfield, ready to testify in the most important assassination in the United States history and maybe in the world, the murder of John Kennedy that ordered our entire history 20 years ago. And now, if there were over 127, 130 primary witnesses, and people like Georgia Morenfield died the day that the House Select Committee was supposed to have their first interview, and we see mobsters that go and judges that are killed and lawyers that are killed, and the investigator for the Sinfuel who was killed, and the fellow that was in charge of the housing contracts for HUD who was killed. He tells me that these are just, have nothing to do with the cases at all. They're just simple deaths that they're ready to expire. I don't believe it, but that's his opinion. So it'll be interesting to see what he has there. Now, in the last 6 months, George Shultz has been talking terrorism, every chance he gets, and Gene Kirkpatrick of the United Nations and Ronald Reagan, and trying to get laws that affect us because of terrible terrorism. But when terrorism shows up on the other side, when it's their team, like Ajab, he worked with the CIA, or Edwin Wilson, and there's evidence that there's terrorism on the right that is created by our agencies, there's this sudden silence. And I want to talk briefly about the kidnapping in London of Prime Minister, Transport Minister Umaro Dikko, D-I-K-K-O, from Nigeria, who was found in a crate because it involved three well-known prominent Israelis, and one is one of the most prominent doctors in Israel. And if it had been Gaddafi, or if it had been a Bulgarian who tried to pull this, or if it had been Arafat, the headlines would have been horrendous. Taking a man with needles in his body and crated up like an animal, and almost dead, that when they took him back to the hospital, they said he wouldn't have made the flight in the company of a prominent doctor from Israel. But when it's the other side, when it's the Israelis doing the kidnapping and not somebody taking their plane down to Entebbe, you get a wall of silence. As soon as they find out how it is, this silence comes in. There was an article in Counterspy last May, Nazi terror death squads in West Germany, and this is about how the CIA set up death squads and was using them there actively just last year in West Germany. That doesn't get much attention. Another story in the news this week about terrorism. Five charged in sell of military supplies to Iran. And these men were indicted and given charges on this particular thing. But when the indictment brought in John Stanley Pottinger, a former assistant attorney general in charge of the Justice Department civil rights from 1973 to 1977, that's quieted down. Sending guns illegally to Khomeini is okay for the Iranians. That's terrorism. But when it's your Justice Department official, that's quieted down. We'll take a one-minute break and then get into some more of this terrorism. But I think that I have a file that I call Terror on the Right, where if I want to show the terrorism coming from the CIA, the Defense Department, the Nazis, the Klan, the plans to invade these islands, and so forth. But when it's the left, we hear about it over and over again. So we have this Justice Department fellow, Mr. Pottinger, who's prominent in circles in Washington, and all of a sudden, even though his name is on the tapes, he isn't indicted yet, but the others are. We'll take a one-minute break here first and ask you, again, this is the station that is listener-sponsored. I hear other stations asking desperately for money, like Pacifica, and we haven't discussed it too much lately, but I know that we're going to have some fundraising, and we know they need the money. And I don't know how many of you have been sending in money. You don't have to wait for a special cause. I wish that you would do it now in the summer. There's no taxes, there's no Christmas expenses, there's no income tax or house taxes. This is a good time to send away $15 if you're a student or a senior and $25 for a basic backer. And if you're clear, $40 this month, you can be a patron of the airways. And if you have a lot more, you just call and I'll be at the station after the program. Don't call me unless you have more than 40 and I'll tell you what you are. You're an angel. Send money to the station and help support it because it really is needed.